Guess I should get started. Let me beg everybody to close ranks here. As I said, blobby seat arrangements turn into blobby conversation. People use it as a license to disengage. They're only half with you, depending upon where they're sitting. And so, I understand that. I want to provide that opportunity to someone if they're, like, insistent. But at the same time, I want to encourage people to get in, because I find they engage the topic better the closer in they come. We're in James chapter 4. This is actually our seventh lesson in James. Next week will be our last. Actually, we'll be in chapter 4 and chapter 5 today. So, think about the book of James again. Reorient yourself to it. A Catholic epistle. It's written to the church at large, so we don't really have a church that we can examine and find their story. We think the brother of Jesus himself wrote this, although that can't be said with absolute certainty. It's a peculiar book in the New Testament. It has lots of elements to it. Only mentions Jesus Christ by name two times. In that. It has a lot of rich visual imagery. It has prophetic announcement in it, and it's got some of the qualities of the wisdom literature going in it. Really a fascinating book. Now, one of the things that's always interesting to do is when you're looking at Scripture is to get a picture of the book at large and then bigger context. So often our devotional reading isolates things, and you don't really think, well, how does this fit together? People aren't just sort of making pious remarks at random, talk about this for a few sentences, jump to that for a few sentences, and it has nothing to do, no flow, and one part of it doesn't have anything to do with the other. I think, well, James is tricky like that, because it's one of those books where you think, wait a second, how does this fit together? Now, I've said one of the things that works against us in this in Bible study is, of course, chapters and verses. These are not part of the sacred text, you could say. I mean, they're not in there with the Bible writers. That's something that editors have done. The editors were early on. I think it was the Latin Bible back in the early Middle Ages that was divided into chapters. And then I think it's around the 13th century sometimes it gets divided into verses. Sometimes those chapters cut thoughts in half, though, and you think, well, wait a second, it's not like a year elapsed between chapter 4 and chapter 5 when the person was writing a letter anyway. These things flowed from one another. We'll see this happens in chapter 4 and 5. So let's look at the end of chapter 4. And could I get somebody to read for us, let's see, 4:13 through 17. Okay, we've got that little big word, pericope, sitting there at the end of the chapter. Look back, scan back through there and tell me, does it have anything to do with what we have identified as being part of chapter 4? Now remember we said chapter 3, if we took the idea of teachers and ran it down through the chapter, we saw a kind of line that held that chapter together. Not a bad call to put it all in one chapter, but it's not immediately obvious why it would have been done. Chapter 4 might do the same thing to you, but I want you to look back through there and say, how does it fit, maybe? Can you get anything? Can you find a line that might link this? Is what I said, or is just a guy just throwing out pious things by paragraphs at random? Perhaps this is a question that requires too much intellectual energy at this point in a Sunday morning. I totally sympathize if that's true. Well, I think it's very interesting. He starts with this idea of fighting and quarreling. We said it as apparently is confined to a certain kind of context here. You don't ask. And you don't ask for the right reasons. Well, it seems to me you're saying that, well, there's a lot that we don't know and need answers for that we have to seek. There's a kind of a a lesson in humility there, that our self-interest and our aggressive self-interest has to be shaped by asking God for those things that we don't have and asking with the right motive. And then he gets into this lesson on humility starting in 7 through 10 then, right? Say, all right, be this kind of person that can submit to God and resist the devil and draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. So you see, well, that kind of ties to the beginning of the chapter. Rather than be aggressively self-assertive about your own interests, this just tears up Christian fellowship, causes you to make all kinds of judgmental and evil remarks. Instead, be the kind of person who works with humility with other people. And then when we get to 11, don't speak evil of one another. I think, well, that ties us to the beginning of the chapter, doesn't it? We're talking about quarrels and fighting in the church and wars. He who speaks of an evil of a brother judges his brother. He speaks evil of the law. There's one lawgiver. Who are you to judge another? Remember, we've talked about all this. It's been the substance of the last two classes. And now we start with that great phrase. How did yours start? When you read, come now. Anybody have anything else?
Now listen.
Anybody reading King James? I think it says, go to.
Go to now.
Ye that say, go to now, ye that say. For some reason, this book just like brings out all the King James in me. I don't know why. It's just like when I first became a Christian, I was not a candidate for success for Bible reading, but I was, in my ignorance, God protected a fool. I mean, I had a King James Bible and read it for 2 years, and it infected me badly. That's many, many, many years ago, but I've still got this sort of like door every once in a while that pops open with this Elizabethan English, and it's like, yeah, that's the scripture right there. You know, I have that in common with people who are much older than me who grew up in the faith, which I didn't. Anyway, I was long past the King James crowd, you know, in life. You know, it's more like Jimi Hendrix when I was that age. Was in the other closet ready to jump out any moment. All right, so come now. What's this got to do with anything else in the chapter? Who do you think you are? Anything else? I'd say presumption, right? Presume to know that your interest should step ahead of someone else's, that your judgment of another person would be good. And now you're presuming what? Well, go to now, ye who say what? What are you presuming? You know the future, and you know what the future will deliver to you, which in this case will happen to be money. Yeah. Well, that seems like a reasonable thing to do, right? I mean, you think, well, you know, what businessman doesn't look ahead and plan and see the lay of the land and hope that if they do certain things, they'll put their plans in place and that'll lead to a profit. But it is presumption, right? It presumes you know something about the future, which you cannot know. No one knows, right? I mean, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's a great given of human existence is we don't know what happens next. There's no logical force, for example, to say that the sun rises tomorrow, right? There's no logical argument that insists that. You could say present, what's been rising a lot. Well, a lot of things happen a lot. But how do you know it's going to happen again? You don't know. There's no philosophical argumentation that can tell you that something's going to happen again just because it's happened before. It's just a guess. Isn't that a fascinating thing about human existence? I mean, we just play probabilities, and probabilities can be wrong. All right, so it seems to me if there's a coherent line to be drawn here, it's an attitude of humility that says you must draw near to God to get this stuff. You're mistaken when you assert yourself that it's presumption, that instead you go and you ask God. Now, we're talking about a class of people here. Everybody's in a class, right? What are classes of people? Because we're going to keep working with this. Class of people. What group is under consideration here?
You get rich, poor, middle class, hollowed out middle class, working class.
Yeah, you'd have economic classes. But I don't think that's exactly where James is going. Now, some economic classes are bound to have more money than others, right? Like businessmen are likely to have more money than scholars, at least in my experience, unless you happen to know something. I don't know, maybe I missed the assembly or something like that, but I pursued a scholarly life, and it doesn't make a lot of money, does it? You know, I used to say when I got out of college, I was equally unemployable in several languages. But a business major, I'm assuming, could be wealthy and a pathetic monolingual. But, you know, we don't want to make any judgments here that would be inappropriate, but some of you are laughing. So please believe me, I'm not serious. Economic things are, I don't think that, what, but classes could be based on, say you have students. Is that a class? Yeah, the class of students. There's characteristics of them. The class of parents. The class of... What class are we looking at here? What's that?
What?
Okay. You have the class of artists. I'm just going to keep the class. You have the class, in each subdivision, you have the painters, the dancers, the writers, the actors. You'd have the students, graduate students in under elementary school, parents of little children, parents of high schoolers, parents of college students, you know, parents whose kids have, flown the nest, so to speak. And we go down this list, and here we're dealing with what class in 13 through 17? Well, merchants. It's a merchant class. These are the entrepreneurs. These are the people who make the world go round in some ways. I mean, they're the most critical class, right? I mean, without this class of people, you're in trouble. And so you could assume that this class is represented in the church. It's not surprising. James has already taken on another class of person and addressed them bluntly. What was that class? It was in chapter 3.
Teachers,
yeah. This is a teacher class. And he said, all right. He's looking at the church at large. And they're teachers. This church, I mean, you realize how over-teachered we are at LCF? I mean, like, there are so many teachers in this congregation, it's frightening. It really is. I mean, it's just like, pick an average congregation. You just don't have it. So when James is speaking to teachers, he's looking at a church. He said, there are a lot of people in this category here. There are temptations. There are things to look out for. Now he's saying, a lot of merchants in the church. Now what's my advice for them? Well, what is his advice for them? His advice for teachers was, don't do it. He's talked about the power of speech, about talking about sort of the presumption that can come from teaching. Now he's talking to merchants.
Prophets?
Yeah. Well, it's just the idea that you'll make a profit. You don't know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life?
That's so poetic, but it's so grim. I mean, it's...
Yeah, well, this is, once again, we talked about James and his visual imagery, right? So what's your life? It's a mist, and it vanishes. Well, what's this say to the people in the merchant? I'm not in the merchant class. Would a merchant speak, please? I mean, would somebody who runs a business step up here and say, how do you own this thing?
Don't you think he's maybe minish, telling people not to put away too much in a storehouse and not to plan maybe too much into the future because... you might not ever see that future.
Yeah, can you think of a statement by Jesus that matches this? Kind of a story. King James just popped out of the closet again. Thou fool, thou knowest not. Right? So the guy who said, what'll I do? I'm making all this money. I'll pull down my barns. I'll big build bigger barns to store all my stuff. And Jesus says, you know, but the Lord says, you fool, you don't, you know, this night your life will be required of you. And what will happen to those things you've stored up? I think, well, that comes right out of the mouth of Jesus, right? I mean, and I think there was a thou fool in there, if I'm not mistaken. It was a bad investment, right? Well, you think about this. I've known some people who are just incurably entrepreneurial. I mean, they seem to make money and start businesses in their sleep. I mean, I always wished I had that gift, and I just don't have it. But I mean, they just seem to have it. But they can obviously get that invested, over-invested. They can lose their spiritual sense. They can lose themselves as Christians in that, can't they? Well, I think they can. I feel like that there's the possibility that you apply it wrong. And so here's the warning to the merchants in the church, the merchant class in the church. Your plans are always subject to change because you don't know what the future is, and investing things right would be important. And I think it fits with the rest of chapter 4, doesn't it? Humility, coming before God, you know, the things you don't know, the things you must ask God for. Okay, well, I think so. I think not knowing isn't the sin. He closes it with a proverb, right? He who knows to do right and doesn't do it, for him it's a sin. I don't think he's saying that the ignorance of the future isn't the sin. What would the sin be? Yeah, or the presumption of assuming that your plans have to go in a straight line. I mean, not to suggest that good planning is a bad idea, but just to suggest you know outcomes. That would be the sin. It's the only way I can tie the proverb in. Otherwise, it's just like saying, you know, at the end of a passage, and floss your teeth. I mean, it might be wisdom, but why does it apply? Why would he drop it in here? Well, because he's saying, you now know to do good is to draw near to the Lord in this, recognize the uncertainty of your condition, not to do that. That's it's not knowing that is the sin. It's not the appeal to God. All right, let's move to chapter 5. I think chapter 5 then continues in this thought. Now, he actually gets at it a little bit differently. Would somebody start with 5? We're going to read through 6. Let's see. Why don't we just read the whole thing? Now, 5 through 6. Or 5, 1 through 6. Need a reader. Okay. And you have, how did yours start again? Come now?
Now listen.
Yeah, now listen. That's the same one you had, right? Now listen. What did you have? Come now. That's what you had, and that's what I have. Anybody have any more? I love those introductions. What's
go,
key?
Go to now, you rich man. Weep and howl over your miseries. Come upon you. I like that.
Yeah. Well, what is this? I've said that James has done this before to us. How have we described this? Yeah, remember we said that there are other places in this book where suddenly this ferocious prophet rises up out of his seat. We saw another, adulterers and adulteresses. And wow. And now suddenly this, we've been building up. We've talked about teachers. We talked about merchants. And now suddenly this ferocious individual has risen up to speak for the Lord and address people. The pulpit commentary said, this could be a leaf torn right from the pages of the Old Testament prophets. And you think, well, who is it addressed to? If we're thinking of classes of people, can you see a class of people here? Now, the temptation would be to say it's economic, but is there any indication of what end of an economic class you might be addressing here? Yeah, that's the economic class, but there'd be rich people, you know, or actors.
It would be like the lords and the kings and stuff like that.
Yeah, and in particular, well, look at what they're doing specifically, and it might tell you where their wealth resides. Yeah, except not, we're not talking about the yeoman farmer, right? We're talking about the
landowners.
Yeah, the landowner class.
Well,
think about it. I mean, how do you hold capital in those kind of societies? I mean, you don't hold it in stocks. I mean, you hold it in land. I mean, these landowners were these were like evil beyond even plantation owners, right? This is a class of people. And it seems like if he's given teachers and merchants just some advice, how would you describe his attitude toward the class of landowners? Yeah. What do you think? You got the feeling, like with teachers and now like with merchants, that he was talking to insiders. I mean, if nothing, don't you get the feeling like these were people in the church? Do you get that same sense when we jump to chapter 5? Oh, okay. I have a different word there. Yeah.
So what do you have?
I have the just. I've the just. You've murdered the just.
So is he talking
about Jesus? No, I don't think so. Murdered the just. He does not resist you. The way that's in present tense for me, that didn't send me to Jesus. Does yours keep stay in present tense?
It's the innocent one. I don't know. I just shut off my phone.
If it said he did not resist you, that might have sent my mind back to Jesus, but I didn't get that when I was reading. But if maybe you got something. Anybody got that? I'm staying in present tense there. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you.
Mine's all plural. You've condemned and murdered innocent men who are not opposing you. So does that sound like outsiders who are persecuting Christians?
That's my inclination in interpreting this, and as I was going through commentaries on it, seems like a lot of Bible scholars think that too. Of course, you know, that's always dangerous territory because, you know, 10 of them could be wrong, you know, something like that. But the idea that up till now he's been addressing insiders in the faith, but now his ferocious attitude is focused outside the church. He's identifying the rich as people not in the fellowship. I don't know, though. I mean, it doesn't say so explicitly, does it?
Well, no, and he uses the same intro. Now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city. Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail. I mean, he's not really, I'm not sure you can get that from there. I wish you could. But.
Well, he has been very, very hard on the rich. Let's look at chapter 1 again. We get back to chapter 1. And he talks about count it all joy, all your trials. And in verse 9 and 10, what does he say? Would somebody read it? So it's sort of like a good overture to an opera, right? I mean, he's already introducing his theme. The rich can rejoice that they're humiliated and that they're going to fade away. Sounds like cause for celebration to me. I don't know about you.
But we're rich.
Oh, are we? Look at chapter 2, verse 6. Would somebody read that to us when we come along? When you come along. Thank you. Yeah. So his attitude towards the rich is pretty harsh, right? Now the question is, does he regard them as outsiders or insiders? Is he looking outside the church door when he gets to this group of people, or is he addressing the church? Vicky, you're inclined to say he's addressing people in the church, as much as you don't want that to be true. I thought he's probably like, you know, they'd have little flyers that could slip them under the door of the rich person's house, you know. That's detachable there. You see the little perforation. You go down the street to the rich guy's house and slip that under their door. Well, this one is always really tricky for us for a couple of reasons. I mean, well, think about it. If it is addressing people in the church, the first question is then what?
Is it me?
Is it me? Yes. Is it I, Lord? You know, famous quotation from
Judas.
Is it I, Lord? Well, that becomes a tricky question for us, right? Because you can meet lots of very wealthy people. Do they ever regard themselves as wealthy? Well, rarely. Yeah, I when I was in high school, I was around a very wealthy community, one of the wealthiest communities in the United States. And a lot of my friends in high school, very strange for me to be around them because I was not from that class. But it was startling, I mean, how much money some of these people had and how none of them really regarded themselves as rich. You know, the real rich were somewhere else living a little better. But these guys are pretty wealthy. I mean, I had a couple of friends in high school, probably never would have to work. I mean, if they wanted to, they could coast on the family fortune, you know, pretty easily and live better than I would ever live. But they didn't regard themselves as rich. Rich was always somebody else. Now, this runs us into problems, too, because think about it historically in our situation. Very few of us would consider ourselves self-consciously rich, but when you look at us both in international terms and historically, we are fabulously wealthy, aren't we? It's said that even a poor person in the United States at this point is probably considerably more powerful economically than counterparts back through history in other lands. And so you'd say, well, yeah, maybe it is I, Lord. Now, so that makes it tricky then, say, well, how then do I avoid the trap if I'm being addressed here? So exactly what were these rich people doing? Now, some of it, of course, is denunciation. Weep and howl, your miseries are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver corroded. Their corrosion will be a witness against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. What does that last phrase mean? You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Yeah, well, that sounds like the last day. I mean, I think we want to diagnose what these rich people were doing that called this ferocious response out of James. And in particular, if I think I might be one of these people, I want to see what they did and see if I can get off the hook, so to speak. So they heaped up treasure. I don't think that requires a lot of imagination. You know what that would mean. I mean, you're tearing down your barns and building bigger ones. You're investing in this world, in this earth. This, it becomes everything. But it's in the last days that strikes me as interesting there. Now, you're thinking sort of like the last day of fire and flame and that stuff. But anybody else want to take a different stab at that? I think that's the best way I have of looking at the last days. Now, it's kind of common in Bible studies to think that there appears to have been the thought in the Bible writers that the return of Jesus Christ to establish kind of the next phase, the last judgment, that this was all coming upon them really quickly. The idea that they don't seem to anticipate millennia going by without the return of Christ. And so that this is a big shift in church history, of course, is the idea that it's, Jesus could maybe not be here tomorrow, but yet then the call to say, but you must live as if he will, that everybody has to live in that idea. So that the last days, as I understand them biblically, are really everything that's ushered in with the arrival of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God through Jesus Christ, we're in the last days. This is it. And it's no time to be heaping up treasures on earth. That in a sense, we all live in anticipation that this has no eternal value. Now, It's intriguing because you think, well, you could drop over dead tomorrow, of course, and that would be one way of interpreting it. But I think bigger, get bigger picture. It's the idea that what have you invested in through eternity? I mean, you know, Rob had some of that going with physical exercise, right? I mean, what's valuable in eternity? But what is it that's a value period for the human race? It's not heaping up treasures. They heaped up treasures. This was their first offense that he lists. You heaped up treasures in the last days. What's the next thing they did?
They're withholding wages. They're keeping for themselves and fattening themselves on what was due for other people.
Yeah, well, let's take them one at a time, though. I mean, assume the elements are significant in isolation from one another. Withholding wages. Does it have any appropriate application in the 21st century?
Every corporation in the country. I mean, they pay you as little as they can to make as much profit as possible.
That's just good business, isn't it? Well, I think the withholding is interesting. You know, I've actually had, like, there's that idea, I mean, because I've had crummy jobs because I was a scholar and not a business major. So I've had wages withheld, not you know, by the court, but I had a guy who didn't give me my last paycheck. I had to, like, hound him for 4 months. And that was a problem because I lived kind of hand to mouth, you know, so I've had that. But I've also had the low wage job thinking, there's something quite, you could be paying us a little better here, and that would work. Of course, there's no law requiring that. But withholding wages, do we extend it out into the idea of these kinds of broader ideas? I'm not sure. I'll just say, I'm going to look at this closely because I suspect we're kind of rich. Let's see. The wages of the laborer who mowed your field, which you kept back by fraud. Maybe that's the key, right? Is there anything fraudulent in the wages you pay? Middle Ages, by the way, were more radical about that. You know, our society is very unregulated compared to the history of Western civilization in regards of what you could pay. There were very, very strict standards about that kind of thing. Well, what else did they do? Because we got the individual. I mean, the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. But what's the next thing they did? I think it's in verse 5.
Lived in luxury and self-indulgence.
Yeah, lived in luxury. So what's luxury? And that's the other place where this begins to really work on us, right? Because our lives are relatively luxurious compared to previous generations of lives.
Live.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much are we taking advantage? I think about the things that we buy that are made in third world countries where there's child labor and not a living wage, and we're consuming those goods.
It's hard to know how to play this one, I think. Yeah, I think. Because you're not in the position to make the corporate decisions that do these things. You think, well, yeah, it's a horrible thing that we're doing or participating in, but at the same time, sometimes it's the only thing keeping people alive in other places. They, well, what do you do about that? You know, yes, you know, maybe they are making the Nikes in a sweatshop in Vietnam somewhere, but at the same time, there are people competing for those jobs and want them desperately, or in Latin America and some of the fruit things that Del Monte owned and stuff like that. Very, very tricky to know what to do this. What else did they do? They lived on luxury. And what else did they do? Verse 5? Yeah, self-indulgence. I'm going to just put that in the same phrase. It's sort of there's a word for it, but I'm not going to say it. Self-indulgence. I mean, isn't luxury just by its nature kind of a self-indulgence? But what is it? They did something else in verse 5.
Content and daring.
Yeah, well, they got that up. Yeah, that's in 6.
Fatten yourself in the days of slaughter.
Yeah, yourself that you have, or do you have fattened their hearts? What do you picture there with that?
Like an animal that's getting fattened up.
Yeah, but they're
being slaughtered.
Doing it to themselves, though. I was thinking like foie gras, do you know that stuff? They're forcing stuff down the gullets of geese to make their livers fat. You know about foie gras? Yeah, that's like one of the grimmer ones like that. But it's like if you were doing it to yourself. You know, you're fattening your heart. You're getting this. But so I'm thinking, is it something that, yeah, well, this is this idea of just a kind of a gluttony is involved in it, right? This is self-indulgence, just taking, overfeeding, I guess, is how I'm looking at it. And then in 6, they have condemned. So fattened, condemned the just. And what?
Murdered.
And even murdered. So, what I want to ask, though, and this is the kind of the question to close on, is, are we immune from this? Is this talking to us? Or is this safely dispensed in the first century to a class of people in an empire that's long since become history? Is there any of it that bites us, shall we say? Who said all of it?
We did.
We did. All of us. Yeah. I suppose there are lots of places where you'd study it biblically and you'd just say, oh, so it's really nice that James went after him, you know, give it to him. I don't know. I just feel like there's something about it that gets me, and I don't think of myself as terribly wealthy as a person, you know, I just, but is it there?
Anytime you're looking to add to your, and let's face it, most of us, not all of us, but most of us in this country have excess. Anytime you're looking to add to your excess at the expense of someone else or your own integrity, you fall into this category.
What can you do about it? What's that? Yeah, I would think that would be. He said, be mindful. That's what you said, right?
Yeah. It's almost a part of your nature to want more, but at the same time, exactly. You have to keep yourself in check.
Be generous.
Yeah, I, you know. There are people who would attach a political agenda to it, and I'm thinking, no, that doesn't work. Nobody's scheme to redistribute wealth has ever really been very successful, I mean, at least systemically. But generosity never fails, I don't think. You know, it may not shift systems around, but system shifting seems to always just put a new boss in place, you know, a new class of the privileged in place. But I think the Christian heart that's redeemed can go for generosity. Reggie, were you going to say something? I have this feeling, we have to close, and I have the feeling like I've bummed everybody out here. So anything we can say to lighten it up? Amen. Well, you could look at 7 and see one of those, therefore. Therefore, be patient, brethren. Be patient till next week. Usually these letters turn around and don't end on this kind of tone. But good word, Jack. Thanks. See you next week. Next week's our last one on the book of James. So.